Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. This week, a riveting Eastern Kentucky account of experiencing and recovering from addiction. You'll hear my conversation with Mandy Scheffel, author of The Nature of Pain, Roots, Recovery, and Redemption Amid the Opioid Crisis. And we're joined by Jennifer Hancock from Volunteers of America on the expansion of Freedom House in Clay County and how it's changing the lives of mothers and pregnant women battling their way out of addiction and keeping their families together in the process. First, a wake-up call. It's estimated that the Social Security Retirement Trust Fund is on track to run out of money in 7 years. That's in 2032, when today's 60-year-olds reach their normal retirement age, and that's a year sooner than the program trustees' most recent estimate in June. The earlier date results from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Other important government programs, such as the Highway Trust Fund and Medicare Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, also face insolvency in the near term. But today we're focusing on Social Security. And to talk about that, we're joined by Mike Murphy. He's Senior Vice President and Chief of Staff at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget in Washington. Welcome, Mike.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And first, let's establish what the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget is.
So the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization based out of Washington, D.C. And our mission is to educate the public and policymakers about issues that have a significant fiscal policy impact. And primarily, our mission is to raise awareness, particularly about what we believe is an unsustainable course that our federal budget and our debt and deficit situation at the federal level is on. We do that through a variety of means, through policy analysis, reports, tons of things one can find on our website about this at crfb.org. And we also work with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, try to promote fiscal responsibility and raise attention to it in a variety of ways through the media, which is why I so appreciate you having me on, as well as through public education, lots of events, speaking opportunities as well.
Ordinarily, I wouldn't dwell on this, but under current circumstances today, I think it's important to our listeners to understand when you say bipartisan, what does that mean?
So we are completely nonpartisan in our analysis and bipartisan in our makeup. And what I mean by that is we just follow the numbers. We have a lot of analysts here, and we look at the numbers, and the numbers are facts. We call it like we see it in terms of what we think the budgetary impact is based on policies that folks are advancing. So it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. If you're doing something that's going to worsen the fiscal budget situation, we're going to analyze it and we're going to call attention to it. And if you're doing something to improve it, well, we're going to help and work with you as well. And we're bipartisan in our makeup in that we have about 30 or so staff that work with us. And the staff's political affiliations range from far left to far right and everywhere in between. We just work night and day a lot of times to advocate for fiscal responsibility in a nonpartisan way.
Okay, let's get down to brass tacks then. What proportion of Kentucky seniors receive Social Security benefits?
Based on the numbers, it looks like about 825,000 Kentuckians are on Social Security based on the most recent numbers. But you alluded to where the Social Security program is headed, because we did some numbers and analysis on that as well. Mm-hmm. And here's the context for your listeners. So as you said, in about 7 years, it's estimated that Social Security is no longer going to be able to pay its scheduled benefits. It is going to become insolvent. The trust fund will exhaust its reserves. And what that means is at that time, by law, it's required to, at that time, match expenditures in the program with whatever revenue is coming in. And we estimate what that would require by law, it would be a 24% across-the-board cut to everybody on the program. What that would equate to, we estimate, is about an $18,400 benefit cut for your typical two-earner retiring couple at that time. And what that means for your state is we estimate that that 825,000 beneficiaries of Social Security today is going to grow to about 950,000 is what we estimate. So 950,000 folks in Kentucky in 7 years will be subject to that 24% across the board cut if we continue on the path we're on.
And so this ballooning of that senior demographic is happening all over the country.
That's right. The line that one hears all the time, and you hear this from politicians on both sides of the aisle, this is not a partisan statement, is because of Social Security's the quintessential third rail, so to speak, both parties kind of outcompete each other to talk about how we're not talking about Social Security. We're not touching Social Security. The bottom line here is, by not touching Social Security, you're guaranteeing that 24% benefit cut in 7 years.
What does the future look like for a younger listener who's out there hearing us talk about this and is a working person? They're having Social Security taken out of their paycheck. What does the future look like if nothing is done to stop or at least slow this decline in revenues that support Social Security?
It's a really important question. So we've talked about this with lots of different audiences and all sorts of forums, and it always comes up that actually younger generations, by and large, are incredibly cynical about the state of Social Security going forward. They don't believe it's going to be there. They're actually not counting on it. They've heard a lot about kind of its. They don't know the details, but they know something's off on its finances, and so they're just not betting it's going to be here. Now, on the one hand, that's an understandable perspective to have. But on the other hand, it actually overstates the problem. So as I said, when you get to that point of insolvency, it's going to require a 24% cut to make it solvable. Now, that's significant, but it's not 100%. But this is a solvable problem. The gap is solvable. There is lots of ideas that people have been putting forward over the years on how you adjust revenues and benefits going forward prospectively to make it solvent. So the message to the younger listeners that care about this is ask your member of Congress, what are you going to do to rescue Social Security? We know it's going insolvent. Don't tell me you're not going to touch it or not going to talk about it, because if you're saying that, this insolvency is coming down the line. What's your plan? They have to have a plan to rescue Social Security. That's what they need to be hearing from the younger generation.
Well, I know around here that is the usual inclination. I'm going to call my congressman. I'm going to call my senator. However, Congress seems to have relinquished its powers of the purse to the presidency. And in light of that, can we any longer look to our elected representatives to make sure Social Security remains solvent, that it is touched?
We're going to have to. I know I obviously understand the point about what's perceived as Congress sort of abdicating the power of the purse. And in a lot of cases, they have. Look, Congress has not passed a meaningful budget, realistic budget, in years. They haven't passed all their appropriations bills, which is what they're arguing about right now, that about the threats of shutdowns. It has to do with appropriations. They haven't passed all their appropriations bills on time at the end of the fiscal year in decades. So the budget process is broken in Washington, and they have abdicated a lot. But there's only so much the executive can do when it comes to budgeting, and they're obviously testing the bounds of that. When you're talking about a policy as large and significant as Social Security, you're not solving or dealing with Social Security at the level it's going to be need to be dealt with without legislation. There's not going to be any way to deal with it without legislation. You're going to require Congress. There is arguments that are made about how we need to root out waste and fraud. Maybe the executive has power over that, and that's going to solve the problem. We need to root out any waste and fraud that might exist in all federal programs, including Social Security. That's a drop in the bucket in terms of what's really driving that insolvency gap. And so it's going to require legislation. And I'll leave you with a little bit of hope and optimism on that point specifically. One of the things that we realize is you got to think around political election windows. And unfortunately, like a lot of things, is obviously driven by politics in Washington. And this date that's coming of insolvency, when folks go to the polls next year for congressional elections, this will be the first time that they'll be voting for someone on the Senate side because of six-year terms, that their term is likely going to be within the window of when that insolvency date is going to happen. So they can no longer avoid it from a political window standpoint. And certainly whoever's running for president in 2028, that'll be the case as well. So the window's there now. It hasn't been there in the past. That gives me some optimism. You're going to have to get people to start to talk about it because it's going to be happening within their terms.
Well, Mike, you've certainly given us a lot to think about here and a lot to talk about here, and we appreciate it. That's Mike Murphy, Senior Vice President, Chief of Staff at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget in Washington. And if you want to know more, go online to crfb.org. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up after the break, a new book goes deep and personal into the opioid epidemic that swept over eastern Kentucky.
It literally was everywhere. Like, it infiltrated all socioeconomic levels, all age groups. It became casual to see it at parties, like normal teenage house parties. It was not uncommon.
And now, a program in Clay County helping mothers with children stick together while recovering from addiction.
It's just transformational for this entire region that this program is accessible now.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Mandy Fugit Scheffel owns the Red Spotted Newt Bookstore in Hazard, and now one of her own books is on sale, and I'm guessing that it's a must-read for anybody who knows Mandy, knows the territory, and knows probably more than they would like to know what it's about. The Nature of Pain, Roots, Recovery, and Redemption Amid the Opioid Crisis is an account of the struggle of coping with addiction and the pain of losing a close friend to the opioid crisis. It's also about growing up in the unique world of Appalachian Kentucky, and it's about something that runs especially deep in eastern Kentucky, culture, connection to place and family history. Mandy, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So first, tell us about your home place, Hales Branch, I believe it is.
It is Hales Branch, and it's a place I could go on about forever, but I'll give you a brief history. Hales Branch is a holler in eastern Kentucky. It sits on the line between Knott County and Letcher County in a community called Red Fox. Hales Branch was named after my grandfather's family. So John William Hale and Elsie Breeding, who are my third great grandparents, were the first to be landowners in Hales Branch. And at that time, it was known as Breeding's Creek. This would have been around 1876. And so now I currently own what's left of that plot of land, 45 some odd acres. And parts of it have been sold off due to family moving out of the region. One of the original structures, one of the original cabins that was built on the property in around 1897 still stands there today. And I've been working on renovating that and keeping it stable for future generations. And it is definitely by far one of my favorite places on earth to be.
In your book, you describe being out in those woods and the creeks and so forth and how clear that water was and the smells and the sounds. Can you share a little bit of that with our listeners?
You know, I think about place in particular and how important that is in eastern Kentucky. I can't talk about Hales Branch without talking about my grandpa, because I think he's one of the reasons why it was so special. And he really had a closeness with nature. And looking back on it, was probably an environmentalist before I knew what an environmentalist was. So he thought it was really important that I knew about the flora and fauna that was around me, and I was able to identify it. And So we spent a lot of time outside. And, you know, as an only child, I mean, it was just one giant playground for me. Like, that's where, you know, I spent a large amount of my time outside playing in the creek and catching red spotted newts. You know, that's part of where that comes from. I have nothing but fond memories about growing up there.
Well, we're going to fast forward just a little bit here now to later in your life. And if it wouldn't be upsetting for you, because I think what I'm about to ask you to do beautifully establishes what your book is about. And I'd like to begin our conversation by asking you to read the letter to Eric that you wrote soon after his death and who Eric was.
Yeah, absolutely. So this opens up the book and gives the reader a little context about what they're getting ready to get into. Eric, I started writing to you, about you, the week you died, desperately hanging on to what was left of the life we shared. We were family. We were best friends. I had this fear that I would forget you. So I wrote it all down. I wrote in the car, and I wrote at home, and I wrote notes on my phone in the grocery store line. Everywhere I went reminded me of you. 30 years of memories, like an assault on my mind. I grieved you and what your life could have been. I grieved that you were taken away. I grieved that I had to leave you to save myself when I got clean. Writing helped me process unfinished business, conversations we never had a chance to have. You live on through me and my work. I'm still here trying to tell our story. I'm here trying to tell your story, the one cut short. You were robbed of the benefits of aging in hindsight. As time passed, I better understood how and why we became addicted. But we were always more than our addiction. If you were here today, we could laugh about these stories and wonder how we made it through. But you're not here, so I'm writing to you and I'm writing for you. The following pages are a testament to who you were, who we were, and who we might have been. As long as I'm here, I will never let the world forget you. I love and miss you, Mandy.
Now, I know that you made a commitment to keep Eric's memory alive through writing and storytelling, as you just did. And you mentioned in the first pages of the book that Eric was your best friend, like a brother, but I believe a cousin, correct?
Yes, first cousin.
Okay. And somehow along the way, the lines blurred between childhood innocence and the onset of drug use. And you describe that vividly in the book. Did that innocence kind of betray you, since it couldn't have warned you about the dangers of drugs? Did you kind of just morph into drug use?
Yes, I think just by the nature of the disease, you know, it's cunning. And in the beginning, there's this mindset that it won't happen to me, that I'm too smart, I'm too self-aware, but neither of those things are able to protect you. You know, and in the end, there's a genetic component that you just don't have control over. And I think historically, we haven't been honest with kids about what drug use looks like, that it's fun in the beginning. And I have good memories. I had good times. But any kind of prevention efforts that I was taught creates this image of what someone battling with addiction looks like. And that's just not a reality. I think it gives us a false sense of control when you begin to use and your life doesn't immediately fall apart. But then one day you wake up and it is very much in control.
So tell us about that transition from good times to waking up one day and realizing you're out of control and you're addicted.
You know, I think I talk about it like it's normal, but I don't know how many people experimented like we did. But, you know, I mean, it started out with like sneaking a cigarette or trying out alcohol, you know, and then by our early adolescence, you know, we were smoking pot. You know, there was nothing out of the ordinary, or at least for us, it didn't feel like there was, to do this occasionally on the weekend. Didn't seem like a huge deal. There weren't a lot of consequences from those actions. And then probably about my junior year of high school, opioids started showing up at parties. There was an influx in our region of opioids. And then, you know, once we tried pills, that changed, especially OxyContin. So what became different with opioids was the physical dependency that you don't really experience with the occasional experimentation, and the availability. Most medicine cabinets in Eastern Kentucky in the late 90s and early 2000s had some form of pain medication in them.
Did you come into OxyContin as a result of being diagnosed with pain, or was it the other path, the recreational path?
No, it was pure recreational for me.
Well, speaking of that then, tell us about Ropeworks Branch.
Right. Well, I think it's funny that you had an affinity for Ropeworks Branch when you read this.
I did, because there was a Ropeworks Branch in Round County, I grew up. So not by that name, but very similar.
All right. So Ropeworks Branch is an abandoned strip mining site in Knott County. And I don't know if the listeners are familiar with what strip mining is, or otherwise known as mountaintop removal, but whole mountaintops are removed. This was a way of extracting coal. And so you're left with just miles and miles of flatland, which is not typical for us in Eastern Kentucky. So a lot of this land then and now is still owned by mining corporations or large landholding companies. So there is an element of public access. You know, a lot of it's not privately owned. So I spent a lot of my childhood on abandoned strip mine sites like these. You know, lots of folks back home, they use these sites to ride ATVs, and it's a form of entertainment. The views are beautiful, I'll say. That's about the only positive I'll have. But, you know, and now they're even used as a form of tourist attractions for trail rides and such. So this was where we went to escape adults. You know, living in a rural area, we didn't have a whole lot of entertainment. So there wasn't a mall or a theater in my hometown. So there was no place to really go that was not under the watchful eye of adults. And so that's where we ended up, was on Ropeworks. And we would camp and build fires and party, do things we shouldn't. It was also a place we felt like law enforcement could not get to us, so it very much became just kind of a hangout spot.
Well, you note in the book that, I'm going to quote here, addiction is an anomaly to people who have healthy coping skills. For most of the population, it's hard to understand the need to gravitate toward things that have a negative impact on their lives. It's slippery and difficult to categorize. So cocaine and then opioids. What's your understanding now of that need?
You know, I get to speak now from a place of recovery. So through that journey, getting to spend time with other folks in recovery who've battled substance use disorder, there's this theme of feeling othered and feeling like they're never fully capable of strong bonds with other people or finding a true sense of belonging. And I know that is especially true for me. And I thought it was just me until I got into recovery and started talking to other people, and then realized this is a common thread for people who have experienced substance use disorder. And so I think that, coupled with childhood traumas and mental illness, is that the drugs provide some sort of relief from that. And once you find this relief, you know, you find yourself in a cycle of just using this to relieve that uneasiness on the inside, I guess is the best way that I can describe it. And so I don't think I ever had an opportunity to develop healthy coping skills. And especially if healthy coping skills are not mirrored or modeled by the adults in your life. And it was prevalent. It was relief that was prevalent.
You write about the effects of addiction on personal relationships and on family, and how it can sever connections and set up this cycle of pain within families. What did that look like in your life?
My drug use impacted everyone around me, my entire family, and not just the family. You know, it was me and my mom, so it's not just the family that's in my household, but, I mean, it's even extended family. it led me and my mom to a terrible cycle of codependence, and it affected my ability to maintain any kind of relationship, which became isolating, and that isolation kind of feeds the addiction. I lost all trust. You know, I had to steal to feed my addiction, as most people do. You know, it's expensive. And so I lost a lot of trust, and that took a long time to regain. And so there's a lot of guilt and shame that comes with it. You know, I think my parents had to look at what their roles were in this. Yeah, there's not a person in my family or even close friends that, you know, we kind of separated, and I had another peer group because at a certain point, the friends that I had who weren't using, they didn't want to hang out with me anymore. So, you know, I think there's not a relationship in my life that wasn't affected by my drug use.
Well, you tell us that your first experience with OxyContin was transformative. It shifted you from carefree drug use to a constant need to avoid withdrawal and the symptoms of it. And that began a cycle of dependence. Tell us more about that.
You know, I'm real careful in talking about this because I don't want to be like the voice of everybody who has experienced substance use.
Understood.
That this is my experience. But there are a lot of similarities, I think. And also, I never wanted to make it seem like after the first one, I was physically dependent, because, you know, that's just not the case. However, OxyContin felt like a warm hug to me. It did not feel like any of the other drugs that I had used up until that point. And as someone who experienced high levels of social anxiety and depression, it was an immediate cure. And I knew it. As soon as I did it, I knew it. You know, I just had never felt so normal. What seemed to be normal to me, that's what I felt after I used OxyContin. And so after that experience, you know, that was the draw that made me keep going back, is because for the first time in my life, I felt like I had found the answer. Like, it was the solution to all the things that plagued me. And so at that point, then when you keep returning to this fix, it didn't take long for the physical dependency to start.
You know, the opioid epidemic, and it really was that, washed over eastern Kentucky like a gigantic tsunami for a time there, not too long ago, actually. In the book, how do you describe the normalization of drug use in your environment, especially OxyContin?
So there was a certain point, I guess this was late 90s, early 2000, especially like 2001. It was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's hard for people to imagine that, but it literally was everywhere. Like, it infiltrated all socioeconomic levels, all age groups. It became casual to see it at parties, like normal teenage house parties. It was not uncommon. And would have been considered, I think, normal experimentation when we talk about cigarettes or alcohol at that time period, was considered normal experimentation for teenagers and young adults. And the problem with that is we all became physically dependent due to the highly addictive nature of this pill. And this is not to mention the people who were prescribed OxyContin due to legit pain management, who also found themselves physically dependent because they were told by pharmaceutical companies that this was a less addictive form of treatment. And so I think that's the perfect storm. You know, you've got people who are in the coal industry with injuries. You've got kids and adults both who have lack of resources to mental health care and health care. And this was the solution. And Eastern Kentucky and Central Appalachia was ground zero for this medication.
Well, we're talking in past tense, but what does it look like now?
So I think we've seen a shift now. At some point, everybody caught on to the fact that, like, hey, this is actually highly addictive, and it's not what it was sold to us as. And we've seen the demise of pain clinics and pain management in that way. a crackdown by the DEA for opioid prescriptions. And so now we see street drugs like fentanyl and xylazine. And unfortunately, those are really dangerous, more dangerous than OxyContin.
Mm. Well, do you think that we need to better understand addiction as a symptom of deeper issues rather than a standalone problem?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I hope that, you know, I think we're close to 30 years in to this opioid epidemic, and I'm seeing a lot of change in the way we approach the treatment of substance use disorder, because I think anybody who knows or has had family members who have struggled with this, we know that drugs and alcohol are the solution to a bigger problem. And like I mentioned, especially the treatment of mental illness in this country, the stigma with getting treatment for mental illness and the lack of health care and resources. And for Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia, you know, it just became what I see as another extractive industry. It was very calculated. And so there were generations of issues that the dependency of this pill is just a symptom of those issues.
Well, Mandy, how have you broken out of addiction, and what are you doing now to stay healthy?
So as of April 27th of this year, I have 20 years in recovery. And the answer to this question has looked different throughout those 20 years.
Hmm.
You know, when I first got out of treatment, I got heavily involved in 12-step program. You know, one of the lessons you hear, the things you learn in treatment, is you have to change your people, places, and things. And I touch on that in the book about what that looks like when your family is some of those people, places, and things, and how hard that is. But it's critical and it's important. So through the 12-step group, I created a new community for myself, people that were like-minded, people that I could go to if I was struggling, people that helped me process and work through some of the things that happened while I was using. And that's where writing came in. You know, when I worked the 12 steps, I had to depend a lot on writing as releasing that pressure valve. And so that's what ended up happening when I came back. You know, after Eric passed, I knew that was an effective way to process emotion. And so that's kind of how this book came about. But for me, it's looked a whole lot like community. And now I find that community in other writers. You know, there was a time that I probably worked too much. You know, I just kind of substituted that uneasiness into working and staying busy. But through a lot of help from a 12-step community, lots of therapy, you know, I've been able to process some of those things that make me feel uneasy inside, and I'm able to sit with them better now and fortunate enough to be able to write about them and hopefully use this platform to help people understand that addiction is a symptom. And then they can be empathetic for people who have found their way into addiction, because I think it's not a straightforward path. And so I hope that people can see that there are a lot of things that lead up to someone using drugs and becoming dependent on drugs. That was one of my goals.
Well, you have really performed a service here. You're a really good writer.
Thank you.
I've got to say, I have to get a stack of books to go through just about every week. And I try to do them justice. I try to read as much as I possibly can, but I can never. It's usually just a skim. I couldn't put your book down. It's I want to say fascinating, but it's more than that, because it's really important. That's Mandy Fugit-Scheffel, author of The Nature of Pain, Roots, Recovery, and Redemption Amid the Opioid Crisis, and owner of the Red Newt Bookstore in Hazard. Thanks for stopping by, Mandy.
Thanks for having me.
Again, hang your head and let me in. Now we
Freedom House in Manchester in Clay County is part of a Volunteers of America residential treatment program for pregnant and parenting women who are looking to get help fighting off substance use disorder while keeping their families intact. And that's about to expand. And here to tell us about it is Volunteers of America Mid-State CEO Jennifer Hancock. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jennifer.
Pleasure to be with you today.
So what is the aim of the Freedom House program and what services are offered there?
Our Freedom House program is very unique because it is the only place where moms can bring all of their kids with her and live together as a family under the roof of Volunteers of America while we're addressing substance use disorder for every member of that family. So from our smallest clients to our adults, we're working in a two-generational way to help preserve this family, keeping them together while they're healing from the trauma of addiction.
And how did Volunteers of America land on Manchester as the place to locate a Freedom House?
Many years ago, I was testifying in Frankfurt on a bill, and the former executive director of Operation Unite, Nancy Hale, was with me. And she approached me and said, "Jennifer, when are you coming to the mountains? We need Freedom House desperately." And I said, "Nancy, all it takes is an invitation. We're never going to parachute into a community without an invitation." And she said, "Well, you're invited." And as it turned out, I had an opportunity to have some of my friends who were at the Elgin Foundation introduce me to the community of Manchester, where they have a state-of-the-art hospital at Advent Health and a community that was waiting and ready for a solution like this. So as I started my due diligence and visiting various communities around Southeast Kentucky, it was obvious that Manchester had the right assets in terms of the healthcare system needed for some of the high-risk pregnancies that we're responsible for supporting and navigating through that prenatal process, to the fact that there was a willing community ready to embrace us. And so the storyline ever since has been about a really beautiful community of support that has wrapped around our program, so much so that we were honored to receive the 2025 Inspire Award at the SOAR Summit because of the Freedom House program and what it's accomplished in the past 5 years.
And so the initial facility opened up a few years ago, I believe, right? Tell us about the accommodations. What are they like?
We moved into an old children's home that had been vacant for a number of years in the Burning Springs community of Clay County. And it's remote in a beautiful part of our Commonwealth. And it accommodates about a dozen families at a time. It really depends on how many kids mom has with her that determines the number of families that we can serve at any one time. We quickly knew that we were going to outgrow this space. And so as soon as the house next door came on the market, we bought it, which has enabled us to serve another three or four families at a time. And again, this allows moms to be with their kids. We have a children's therapist who's working directly with our youngest clients, helping them heal from the trauma that they've been exposed to. So we're really intentional about seeing this program as one that provides primary prevention services for children, secondary prevention services for adults, and then a whole continuum. I'm so proud of the fact that we've built what is truly a first-class recovery ecosystem right there in Manchester, and now more regionally accessible. We've expanded to reach other parts of that region. So everything from a family recovery court to transitional housing, a recovery community center, a workforce reentry program, and then, of course, our signature program, Freedom House, that is now being expanded to accommodate even more families, and it will open in the spring of next year.
So once that happens, once the expanded facility opens, how many women with children will be able to live there?
We'll be able to serve at least 30 women at a time and their children. And this will be in a variety of phases from that first phase, which is truly, we consider it a full-time job. It's 40 hours of clinical programming every single week with a very structured schedule. And then as women matriculate through the program, once they've achieved certain milestones, then that next phase of care, their time spent in the community, thinking about returning to work, returning to school, getting into their own stable housing. And then if they need that extra housing support, we have that available for them now up to 2 years. So our goal is to maintain at least a 3-year relationship so that we can ensure that families are fully stable and ready to be independent and self-sufficient after they finish our program.
This sounds life-changing.
It is transformational. We've delivered 25 healthy babies since our program opened. When you think about the trajectory for those youngest lives, when they don't have to withdraw from substances in a NICU, when they're attached to their mother immediately, where they have the safety and stability of a nurturing environment, it's those lives, and it's the lives of now more than 385 children and more than 400 adults that have been served. It's just transformational for this entire region that this program is accessible now.
You touched on this earlier, but you offer a family recovery court program. And I know that the immediate goal is sobriety and the long-term goal is family reunification. And the program prioritizes healing over punishment. Tell us more about that.
That's right. I have to say that this is a unique gift that we've brought to the mountains because of its success in Jefferson County. The very first family recovery court began in Jefferson with a wonderful team of supporters from our partners at seven counties, Judge Denise Brown and others who were pioneering this model. We watched and learned from the experts and then took this model and emulated it in Manchester. We have an amazing judge in family court, Judge Clint Harris. He has been with us every step of the way. He's now one of the most passionate advocates you'll find for this specialty court. And it's because the outcomes are so compelling. Those families, and these are men and women who are involved in family court because of Child Protective Services substantiating either abuse, neglect, or dependency resulting from addiction. And once those families are identified, they are given an opportunity to voluntarily participate in this specialty court that is run by Volunteers of America. Our staff is comprised of a clinical therapist and a case manager, and they work with these individuals to help them face their addiction head on, to help them make direct amends to their children that have been harmed in this process, and to get really clear about what it takes to be healthy and well and to stay in recovery and to wrap all those supports that they need around them so that they can be successful in complying with the court's orders and staying successfully compliant in a plan of sobriety. Those wraparound supports have been proven to be so effective. We have a researcher at the University of Louisville embedded in this program, and she and her team have been tracking the data that shows there is overwhelming economic savings. There is overwhelming trauma reduction because our families stay together. They're not placed in foster care. Our kiddos stay with their parents. And so those are some of the unique outcomes that this project has shown us, that is, we are capable of doing this when we are intentional about building these specific supports into family court. So successful that we now have 13 of these courts throughout Southeast and Central Kentucky, and now we're moving into West Kentucky too.
You know, I'm really curious about this, about how it works on the day-to-day in a practical sense. First of all, recovery is a very, very, very long process. Do you keep track of families after they've gone through the program to make sure that they don't need help in the future?
Well, I'm excited to tell you that we are in the midst of a 5-year longitudinal study. This is a way for us to prove the long-term benefits, the long-term return on investment of our program. We know every time we deliver a healthy baby, there's an immediate economic and social return. We know every time a woman graduates with a job, with stable housing, there's an immediate return on investment. But what we've never known until now is our babies born at Freedom House kindergarten ready in 5 years. Has mom 5 years later returned to use or had other episodes of incarceration or hospitalization? We now will know definitively the impact that is quantified with third-party objective research, because this five-year studies that we are now 2.5 years into preliminarily has shown that we have increased the legal means by which our moms are feeding their families and earning income because they're in living wage jobs through our workforce reentry programming. They're in stable housing. Their kids are reporting great success and staying with mom. They're healthy. They're well. We're measuring their ACEs, their adverse childhood experiences, and showing a reduction in those. We are measuring hundreds of metrics. And all of that data will help substantiate the real return that we're producing on behalf of the Commonwealth from an economic standpoint. More importantly, even the social return on investment by allowing these families to stay together and continue to be together long after they leave our program. So we're talking to our families every 6 months, and they're participating in this research study. The response rate has been phenomenal. We have almost an 80% response rate, which is really unheard of, which speaks to the relationship that we build with the families we serve from the moment they enter our doors, that this is not just a transactional approach. This is about real relationships and wanting to be a source of support and a part of that network for the long haul, as long as they need us.
Well, let's say we have a young mother here. She has a couple of children, and she has a substance abuse disorder, and she wants to do something about it. She wants to improve life for her family. Does she have to go through a screening process to be accepted?
She does. And the first person that she'll have an opportunity to speak with is someone who has his or her own lived experience. We really think it's so powerful that the first point of action, the first call to action, is made by someone who has been a graduate of our program. So we're really proud of the fact that many of my colleagues are individuals that were once served by Volunteers of America who are now responsible for helping those newcomers feel safe and secure and answering openly and honestly questions about their history of substance use, their medical history, their criminal history, all of the things that we need to know to ensure that they meet medical necessity and that we're the right provider and the right level of care is recommended for them. So after that initial phone screening, we schedule their intake visit. We welcome them into our home. We spend some additional time getting to know them and all the unique aspects of their strengths, as well as some of the challenges that they've incurred, so that we can wrap a comprehensive, highly integrated treatment plan around them. It's medical staff, it's clinical staff, and it's peer support staff, all of whom share co-equal authority over building this integrated treatment plan, where the client's the first area of focus is that person's well-being. And then we bring all those other systems that she may be engaged in, whether it's health, child welfare, legal, bring those other players in the room so that as we're building this comprehensive care plan, we're contemplating any other expectations that may be placed upon her.
Well, Jennifer, I know that Volunteers of America enjoys the support of many private sector partners, but I'm wondering to what extent the organization relies on federal funding and whether the proposed 2026 federal budget is cause for concern.
We are very grateful for the support of both our federal delegation that has supported federal grants, one of which we just learned about last week. We had a SAMHSA grant that was sunsetting for our Manchester Freedom House program. We were delighted to receive a grant from the Health Resources and Services Administration of the federal government, also known as HRSA. And this HRSA grant will support the operations of our Freedom House program. Because of the way that we're designed, a small boutique style program, we believe in serving 25 and 30 people at a time, rather than 250 and 300 people at a time. And why that's important is we're treating trauma. We're not just superficially addressing symptoms, we're treating root causes. And that requires a very specialized therapeutic environment where people can get into some of the deepest recesses of their experience in a safe environment where they're sharing in small groups. We believe that's critically important to our success. But in order to have a business model that cash flows appropriately, Medicaid cannot cover all of our expenses. And so we rely on the generous support of private donors, and then we complement the work that we're doing with state and federal funds. At this point in time, we are delighted to know that there are no cuts that we anticipate directly to the grants that we've received for our Freedom House program in Manchester. Now, of course, the larger Medicaid conversation, it remains to be seen how that will directly impact us. Right. But what I can tell you is we're very proud of the fact that we're the first behavioral health provider in Kentucky to partner with the MCOs to have value-based contracts where they're paying us for the work that we do. More importantly, they're rewarding us for the real outcomes that we're producing for graduates with housing and meaningful work, with babies born free of substance exposure that come right home from the hospital that do not spend a day in the NICU. So we have these innovative payment models that we have been able to drive with the support of the MCOs and the Kentucky Association of Health Plans. And we hope that that can be one solution that can continue to foster an environment of collaboration in Kentucky where payers and providers are working collaboratively to build a model that makes sense for Kentucky.
Well, this certainly sounds like one great program and so desperately needed in that region of our state because it's been hit hard by the opioid epidemic. So a program like yours is very, very welcome. Volunteers of America Mid-State CEO Jennifer Hancock, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Volunteers of America Mid-States also offers an intensive and comprehensive addiction recovery program for men. It's called Liberty Place, and you can find out more about it online at voamid.org, or just give them a call at 502-635-4530. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.